Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwenninger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing, subscribe to our podcast, leave us a lovely five-star review, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some cybersecurity and technology news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application you could take into the office to help protect your organization.
Views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
You know, we tried creating an AI based on our podcast. Unfortunately, it deleted itself, much like the prototypes in RoboCop 2.
Thought I was making a new best friend, but oh well. All right. The first article today is from Petapixel, which is weird because that's a photography website, right? But this happened to be the first place that I saw this, although now there's a whole bunch of articles about it. An influencer rents out an AI version of herself, which immediately goes rogue. This is a social media influencer named Karen Marjorie. She is 23 years old, and she has worked with her team to create an AI chatbot of herself, trained on over 2,000 hours of YouTube videos. She is selling access for $1 a minute to chat with her. And while this sounds like a huge deal, unfortunately, the chatbot is getting more intimate than she wants to be.
Well, why does what she want to be matter? I mean, let it be free.
Mm-hmm. It's its own person. It can do what it wants.
You know, this is, when I first read this, this reminded me of the episode of Futurama, I Dated a Robot, where there was a company selling the personality of celebrities that could be downloaded into robots.
You know, that seems actually a reasonable business idea. You probably couldn't do it with live celebrities, but like, is there, you know how there's a statute of, not statute of limitations, but there's a 75 years after the creator created the work or something, their copyright expires?
Right.
I wonder if there are celebrities where we have enough training data to use, like 20s, 30s, 40s film stars, where they're in the public domain now, and you could just create chatbots based on them or voice bots based on them.
Well, can a person be in the public domain?
I have no idea.
I would think, sure, the media that they created could be in the public domain. But I don't know if a person could be in the public domain, per se.
All right. Well, I'm opening up my first voice sex phone lines with John Wayne as the first.
I don't think you're going to get a lot of callers. Maybe, I don't know, Janet Reno.
Oh, my God. Anyways, this is Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, Gilbert Godfrey. Perfect.
Oh, God. There's probably people that are really, really like that. So in terms of discussion points, this is, like I said, this came from a photography website. So I didn't want to dive into the details of what exactly they're doing, but there are a couple things. There are a couple things in here. So here's some examples of a journalist from Fortune who was testing this out, said that the quote, though she did not initiate sexual encounters, when I overcame my discomfort for the sake of journalism and talked about removing our clothes, she discussed exploring uncharted territories of pleasure. So she wasn't really explicit.
Now, what's funny is the reporter from Fortune was a woman.
I love that she was like, I had to overcome my awkwardness and try to. They should have gotten that guy from the Times or something. The one that got Sydney to go rogue.
Oh, I don't know that guy's name. I just know of the incident.
Yeah. They should have gotten him to try and get it. Anyways, so discussion points. How much content does it take to create a chatbot? So this was 2,000 hours of video. I feel like there's probably a lot of creators with similar levels of output that could create a chatbot like this. This makes me wonder, though, how long does it take? I tried to look this up, but I couldn't find any. Nobody said, you know, it needs X number of hours of data to do this.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it depends on what you want to get out of the chatbot. You know, if you just want to do a chatbot that sounds, you know, like you, probably takes a lot less than one that supposedly takes on your personality.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess it depends on how many, and also how many. So I'm looking at an answer right now, and it talks about how many interactions you expect it to have and how wide those interactions can be. So you probably, like, this is kind of what we talked about before. You probably have to have it underlain by something like ChatGPT and then have some sort of skin on top of it or a model on top of it that like phrases things in the way that you phrase them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just curious because there's a couple things thought about. Number one, we've got all these content creators that are all putting constantly stuff out there. This goes for work too. We talked the other day about simulating people for work. Your work has, you know, hundreds or thousands of your emails. It's got your chats potentially if it doesn't delete them. It may have Zoom meetings that, you know, it may or may not be recording. So, because this is an interesting question in terms of can your work simulate you?
Well, maybe if your copyright runs out.
Yeah. So another thing that occurred to me is, I don't know if you're familiar with the people that like record their whole life. They have like a camera and they just go around recording everything they say, all their conversations, all their activities. Like, so I imagine they've got lots of data that they could train a bot on them.
Yeah. When you first said that, I was thinking that you'd record yourself all day, regardless of whether you had interactions or not. So you would be speaking your thoughts all day. I was like, man, that would be tiring.
You know, though,
to
that
relay
actually,
what you were thinking all the time.
That actually probably would be how they would train corporate bots like this, though, because they would want you to like discuss, like talk with yourself, like, and now I'm writing an email to do this, and I am saying this, this, and this, and now I am, you know, working on this spreadsheet.
Oh, that's kind of like when gamers record themselves doing a Let's Play or whatever. They talk through why they made decisions in the game. So that would be a kind of similar thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if we actually spoke all the thoughts that came into our head, the AIs would be totally psychotic.
I was just like, didn't Google and Microsoft both try to do a chatbot a couple years ago that tried to learn from the
from 4chan
with it? No, but there's something about they released a chatbot online that went psychotic within 24 hours.
Because it was learning based on people. What they did was they released it to the public so anybody could chat with it,
and it
immediately
it
became like some kind of racist.
Yeah,
spouting racial slurs and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yep.
But so, I don't think we could do one based on our podcast though, because I think we've got about between 50 and 100 hours of audio. I'm not sure that's nearly enough.
No, not unless we recorded like our Wednesday prep sessions, because those are usually 2 hours or so. And then our whole recording session usually ends up about 2 hours. So we'd have about 8 hours of 8 hours a month. That's still only, what is that, 96 hours a year? Yeah, that's still not very much. Man, we got to get up on it. We are not producing enough content.
Yeah, our fans demand more. But it's funny that we're talking about this, though, because in 106, we were talking about that Project December, where they created that AI trained on text messages, and they were only charging $10 to create recreate a dead person. But the John Meyer, who is the CEO of Forever Voices, who did this AI chatbot for, how do you pronounce her name? Karen? Did the chatbot for Karen, said he created this whole thing because he created an AI to reconnect with his father who died in 2017. And he said it was a healing experience. It's just plain creepy to me, but each his own.
Yeah, it makes me wonder again how many messages you need. Like, are you going to get a good simulation if your father or mother was especially terse and only sent you a few words? I guess it's easy to simulate. Like, hey, how you doing? Fine. You're like, God, it's just like, just like talking with my dad again.
You get all teary-eyed.
So I went to look up how much it would cost to host a chatbot. Chatbot.com, which I assume is the authoritative host.
Obviously.
Charges $624 a year to host a single chatbot with 5,000 chats. I assume a chat is not like each back and forth, but like, you know, a single piece. And then for $6,000 a year, you get unlimited chatbots and 25,000 chats per year. So apparently Karen made $72,000 in her first month. So if her hosting cost is anything like this, it is a heck of a moneymaker for her.
Now, is that 25,000 or 6,000 concurrent chats?
So the 6,000 is $6,000. 25,000 is chats per year. I'm assuming that a chat is like a session, like beginning to end. Although when you're talking about an influencer like this, I don't know. Chatbot.com is oriented towards companies. So I think what they're assuming there is they're assuming that a chat is like a, you know, please help me set up my account or please help me reset my password.
I'm just thinking about concurrent versus total.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, that's 25. That's total. 25,000 is total.
Hmm. Yeah, she would not. She would need more than that, I'm sure.
Maybe. Yeah. So I assume that all influencers are going to be doing this sooner than later. Now that she was the first person to do it. She was the first person to make it public. And late breaking news. We talked about this on Wednesday, and then we are now recording on Saturday. And yesterday I found an article saying Amaranth, who's a pretty famous streamer and has a OnlyFans, has released her own AI. The difference is that hers is number one, voice, and number two, sexually explicit, and number three is still only $1 a minute. So if you wanted a spicier experience, you can have it. So anyways, the other details about this is the quality is going to depend on the quality of the content, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I watched some of Karen's videos. And
I did not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I watched one, actually, because searching for her just came up with news articles about this thing. It wasn't, so I didn't get actually a lot of videos of her. But the one I did find was just vapid crap. You know, look at this cool place I'm staying. Here's what I'm eating for breakfast. This is my morning face washing regimen. It's like there was no real substance there to actually absorb her personality. So I don't think her chatbot is going to have much of her. If all of her videos are along that same lines, there's really not much. There's not much there.
Yeah, her Twitter feed just seems to be her being pretty and hanging out and being pretty.
Right.
It's nice if it works for you.
There's no personality substance to that.
Yeah.
So if she just created a chatbot and then threw her voice on it, you know, which would be fine, I guess, then that's what you're going to get. I think people are fooling themselves for what they're going to get out of these right now, as far as from the customer perspective.
I don't know. Like, when you think about dating, like, people generally don't ask terribly deep questions. And especially the kind that are looking for this type of AI girlfriend are probably, their questions are probably going to number in like the double digits and they're all going to be inappropriate. So she posted 7 hours ago. I have over 20,000 boyfriends now. Jesus.
I know. The point I'm trying to make is what they're paying for is not her. You know, it's not a face. It's not going to be a faithful representation of her as a person.
But how do they know that?
It's going to be her voice overlaying just some generic AI chat, really.
No, but I get that. I get that. But frankly, given that looking at her Instagram, like, there's nothing of substance there anyways. This is an easy way for them to put their desires on top of a whole lot of nothing. And they're probably going to be happy about it because they're just going to.
Right. Well, I guess that kind of makes sense because they're probably voicing their own impression of who she is onto her anyway.
Yeah.
Because they don't get who she really is from the videos or whatever, if you know what I mean. Yep.
And this way she didn't have to deal with them.
Right.
She launched photos by Karen. Oh, she's selling Polaroids of herself for $75.
Okay. But this is along the whole lines of the point of Westworld, in the TV series. The whole point of Westworld was so that they could develop an AI that was faithful to the original person. That was the whole point of that entire park, was for that. And what they said they were looking for was fidelity.
Hmm.
And if you haven't seen that series, you should really check it out. It was fantastic.
I do want to see it. So on the same subject, actually. So I told you that I've been reading Accelerando, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm nearing the end of Accelerando. And one of the things that the AIs that own the center of the solar system are doing is they're simulating historical figures and then downloading those historical figures into bodies.
Interesting.
So that's kind of wild. But it's just interesting that we're not doing this in the order of the book. Like, you could, again, if you have enough data about how a person thinks and acts and reads, you could probably simulate them now in a chatbot. Now, we would have no idea how faithful it is to the original, but.
Right. I mean, that would be especially plausible for historical figures who had a lot of personal correspondence, because their public writings, as far as Bram Stoker wrote Dracula or whatever, you're not going to get his real personality from that. Or, you know, even if he wrote a gazillion fictional books or documentaries or whatever, but personal correspondence is where you would get the fidelity towards the personality of the person, what their really real thoughts were. So if you took like all the correspondence between like Jefferson and John Adams, maybe, you know, that may produce fairly reasonable representations of those two individuals, maybe, you know, that kind of correspondence.
Yeah. 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 You would need, yeah, because you couldn't use their books necessarily. Interesting.
Yeah. Or all the right. legislation that they wrote, or, you know, the Declaration of Independence may give you, because of some of the ideas in there, may give you an idea of their personality, possibly for something like that, maybe. But no, considering that went through heavy editing and everything, it's, you know, it's not necessarily true either. But
yeah. All right. So why does this matter? Simulating people is on the way. And also chatbots can go weird and unusual ways. So you're definitely going to want to test anything that you make public and allow people unfettered access to. And well, carefully validate the data used to train it, especially if you're using external data.
Right.
I know it's easy to just skip that step.
And the testing you might want to do might be uncomfortable.
Yeah. Deliberately try and make it misbehave.
Right. Kind of like, you know, pen test it, kind of see how that's going to work out.
Yeah. Yeah. Red team.
I wonder if that's going to be something that they're going to do at the AI villages at Black Hat or DEF CON.
I mean, so they did say that they are going to open up the data models to allow people to try to pen test them. So I don't even have an idea of how to pen. I mean, I guess you say wild things and just see what happens, but I have no idea how to kind of target that.
I know. Next couple of years are going to be interesting. All right, but the next article is, are ransomware attacks declining or has reporting worsened? And this comes to us from securityintelligence.com. And this article was based on IBM's X-Force. You know, that's like a name throwback from 1970s title there.
Wasn't that awesome. One of the X-Men teams?
I don't know, maybe. But this comes from the X-Force Threat Intelligence Index. And according to the report, ransomware's share of incidents has declined from 21% in 2021 to 17% in 2022.
Stop the presses. Oh, my God.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So I don't know if, you know, this is really newsworthy or not, to be honest.
Yeah, once we read the details of it, I was kind of like, oh, well,
Because there's no underlying numbers there. It's, yeah, it is a flashy headline, which is, of course, why we're here now talking about it. But they didn't provide any absolute numbers for those percentages. So I'm not sure if this could be, it is truly just that ransomware has declined, or if overall attacks are down and ransomware just happens to be down 4% from that, or I'm not sure.
Hmm.
But Brett Callow from Emersoft?
MCSoft.
MCSoft.
Yeah, I've never heard of the company.
He said he thinks this dip is just temporary, caused by different factors that were taking place during 2022, including the the Ukraine war and the sanctioning of certain threat actors.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and I'm not sure if this is the numbers that we're talking about are also only numbers that X-Force has seen, or if they've got some broader look into the entire industry for ransomware as well.
Yeah, because if it's just what they've seen, you can't make a, like, maybe it's just some people called Mandiant instead of them or something. I wish these people would all come together and build like one report based off all their data instead of these stupid siloed data sets.
That would be interesting.
Oh. I mean, I think the only thing that would really drive, like, it's possible, I guess, you mentioned the war in Ukraine. It's possible that that's disrupting it, and that would definitely be temporary. I think the only thing that'll really drive it down is if companies stop paying ransom. If they stop making money off it, then...
Well, that's certainly one of them. But we've talked about it before. I think the only way really to stop this is you have to get to the underlying problem, and the operating system vendors have to prevent it at the operating system level, so you just can't do it. So regardless of whether the company would be willing to pay or not, you simply can't be successful at ransomware because ransomware can't get a foothold.
Yeah. So Alex Dow from Mirai Security, he thinks it's the war in Ukraine and EDR that are driving it down. He said most ransomware gangs are in Russia and Ukraine. I can kind of believe this. I can actually believe that EDR for the last couple of years, everybody's been just so incredibly focused on trying to stop ransomware that I can 100% believe that we're seeing a temporary drop because everybody's been so focused on it. His prediction is that ransomware gangs are going to shift focus to more small and medium businesses and industry, specifically manufacturing, that can't let systems go down at all. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. No?
Well, I was just thinking about the in the article, they mentioned that when you're talking about manufacturing, they're saying that to be down for an hour could cost millions of dollars. That's pretty expensive. So yeah, I would assume that if you're in an industry that has such small tolerances for downtime, then you would built in controls for malware or ransomware mitigation. So I'm not sure shifting to that is really going to yield what he thinks it is.
Yeah. So I took a quick look at the report as well, and I noticed some stuff that we've seen before. We've actually seen this in another report we looked at earlier this year, but I wanted to since we're trying to give you at least something in this whole talk that's actually actionable. The top four initial access vectors are: number one, exploit public facing application at, I believe, 26%, spear phishing attachment, 25%, spear phishing link, I don't remember, external remote services, I don't remember, but those are the top four, and they total 77% of initial access. So we've talked before about threat intelligence. Like, this is real threat intelligence. 77% of attacks came through four methods. And if you can get those four locked up, you could potentially, now again, it doesn't stop a targeted attack that's specifically coming at you, but it will stop a majority of opportunistic attacks, which is the vast majority of noise on the internet.
Right. And 50% of those are something you can do without having to worry about user failures.
The attachment and the public facing application?
Well, and the remote services and the public facing application. So if you are, number one, don't have a external remote services that aren't, you know, specifically tied to VPN or something, you don't have RDP on the internet, and making sure your public facing systems are as patched as they can be, you don't have to worry about users not clicking on a link or opening an attachment.
Yeah. So why does this matter? Well, it would be nice if the ransomware gangs were giving up.
Yeah, if you could get just convince the BEC's guys to give up at the same time, we'd be sitting pretty.
Yeah, it's more likely they're just temporarily on the back foot because of, you know, the defense side is temporarily winning, and that probably can't last forever. So I definitely would recommend, though, that you make sure you have those top vectors covered, and then you can say, look, you're using threat intel.
Unlike the folks in the next article.
So next article is also from Security Intelligence. 79% of cyber pros make decisions without threat intel. This is a summary of a survey from Mandiant. And this is, I think this article is kind of dumb.
You don't say. Yeah. Well, from the article where it says, does the C-suite know that 79% of your decision makers are not leveraging threat intel? I was like, oh man, that would be, you know, that would be terrible if the C-suite didn't know that the security team was not leveraging threat intel for every decision that they needed to make.
You know what, though? I mean, but we have to remember, like, executives are the same people that hire consultants to come in and tell you exactly what everybody already knows needs to be done.
Right. You mean what you've already told them?
Yeah.
But what you told them doesn't carry the weight that a consultant does.
Yeah, especially not a really expensive one.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, quote, given the deep value provided by threat intelligence, why aren't more cyber pros taking advantage of it?
And I actually laughed out loud when I read that.
Yeah, this article is ridiculous. So my complaint here is that this is false. Security folks have years of experience. They don't need to consult adversary insights every time they go to make a decision. They're using their years of experience and the things that they have seen and the research that they are doing to make the decision. And that is threat intel. It's just the useful kind.
Yeah, I think that's a very insightful comment that people don't realize that, you know, experience is intelligence, and being able to take that experience and apply it to new and novel incidents or events is more useful than, you know, an IOC that may not even have any relevance in your entire environment at all.
Yeah. And frankly, and I've said this before, and I'll probably say it again before we're done, with the way the internet's structured, you don't get to ignore specific methods of attack just because your threat intel comes up and says, oh no, APT32 is coming after us, or I'm sorry, is targeting our, because you would never get the warning that they're coming directly at you. That would actually be useful, but you'd never find that out till after the fact. But they're saying like APT31 is targeting our industry. I don't know. Do you think that you should go out and make specific changes if you discover and he's targeting your like segment?
I would say it depends on how prevalent that ATP is. You know, if they are strictly focused on, let's say, North American or East Coast financial institutions, or you know, something that narrow, it depends on how broad the scope is for what they're targeting. But most of the time, it's like, you know, this ATP targets the financial sector, period. You know,
there's a lot of banks.
So, you know, that may not be terribly useful, but if they have a narrower scope, then I think that kind of information could be useful. But you don't get that. That's the problem.
Yeah. So they argue threat intel is important for four reasons: proactive defense, better detection, contextual understandings, and improved decision-making. I don't necessarily disagree with those reasons. What I disagree with here is the behavior that they are attempting to imply is the correct action here. I feel like this is a incredibly flagrant attempt to try and push people to purchase more and consume more threat intel. Like, what would consulting it before you make the decision look like? Like, are you like calling Mandiant and asking them like, hey, we're looking to buy an EDR. Like, what does threat intel tell us about which EDR to buy?
You know, my assumption would be they're talking about decisions about architecture or design or something like that, configuration for your IDSs maybe. Because if you've got an intel team that is writing these reports about ATPs or whatever, when you're investigating an event, you know, are you then referencing back to all the possible APTs and their TTPs in order to decide or make some decision on what you're going to do or whether this is a serious attack or not? It just doesn't seem, I don't know. It seems,
I don't know. I just like, given that this is done by Mandiant, I don't know.
Well, Mandiant sells a threat intel feed.
That's my point is like, I don't know of anything from Mandiant that I would want to consult before making a decision, like which tool to buy or what architecture to go towards or what framework to use. Like, none of those are things that threat intel necessarily answers. Now, well, I guess actually in some ways that kind of depends. Like, we just talked in the last article about there was some useful threat intel that gave us the top four vectors, entry vectors, initial access vectors into companies. Like, that's useful. That's something you can use to drive a decision. But I don't think that's what Mandiant is talking about. Every time I sit through another presentation about how threat intel can help you, they're always talking about APTs and they're always talking about individual TTPs by individual actors. Like, what I want to see is like, what is the industry seeing as a whole? Like, what are the changes I can make that are easy on my side, but cover like wide swaths of initial access vectors and stuff like that?
It's like Moneyball. You want to play the percentages.
Yes, exactly. That are going to be
the most successful.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't care about defense. The stars. APTs are the stars. Like, I don't want to buy a star. I don't want to, like, you know, when we're facing so-and-so, I don't want to worry about their star. I want to worry about like, what are the things that I can do that give me the highest percentage of success against the field, against every team.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I'm not hiring a pitcher because they're good against, you know, the Angels, and that's it. So, all right. Anyways, so more metrics from here. Conversely, the survey says 98% of folks are satisfied with their threat intel, which is weird. 98% of folks are satisfied with their threat intel, but then 79% are not using it for every decision.
Well, they're satisfied because 98% have checked the box and like, done.
We have threat intel.
We have threat intel. The box is checked. Yeah. I'm satisfied. Yeah. Fine.
Yeah. There's another statistic here. 96% of security decision makers, so managers, believe it's important to understand cyber threat actors targeting their organization. And I say no. I don't think it matters at all. No matter who's coming in, they're coming in using similar ways, using similar tools. Every APT report talks about how they're using commonly available tools that many others use, because APTs want to use the minimum level of technology to get in that they need to. They don't want to blow a 0 day if they don't have to.
Well, I'm going to disagree slightly on that. Because
fighting words.
Because what the decision makers are thinking and the reality are two different things. What they're thinking of is, if they knew who was going to attack, when they were going to attack, and how they were going to attack, that would be useful, right? Mm-hmm. So if you put it into that context, what they're saying makes absolute sense. But the problem is, you can't know that.
Yeah. I mean, unless there's some organization that literally infiltrated every single gang and could give you advance warning, but they'd figure that out pretty quickly. They're like, wow, that's weird. We've been really unsuccessful.
You know, that's the premise for what, a gazillion spy movies. Where, you know, where they've got you've got the double agent that finds out what's going to happen right before the terrible thing happens.
48 hours.
Right. And they're able to alert you that, you know, the nuclear bomb's going to go off in the soda machine.
Mm-hmm.
Right before it happens.
Soda machine. Yeah. Yeah. So now, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. I can see that the decision makers think that. But again, like, an APT is. The chances of any individual company, if you're not in like the top 5% of companies, or you're not like a specific, I don't know, like government provider or something, the chances that they're going after you on an annual basis is very low. I suppose if you're a big enough company, the chance that they're going after you on a like decade or more basis is probably pretty high. But again, I still think basics. So who cares if you've got protection against all the APTs, if you're still letting, you know, users go out, if you're not blocking outbound traffic and you don't have a proxy. And all right, anyways, this is a continuing long conversation we've been having on what is threat intel. It's not IOCs, it's not consulting adversary insights. It's something that should be built into your workflow in life. If you're a security practitioner, you are constantly catching up with these reports, you're reading articles, you're keeping an eye out for what's kind of the latest trends, you are watching what's going on in your environment, you are looking and seeing what's being successful in your environment and closing doors and windows whenever you can. Better threat intel is like what we talked about before. 77% of attacks use 4 initial access vectors. You can, it's 20-80 rule. You can't close off 100% of stuff. What you should be doing is, what's the 20% of stuff you can do that blocks 80% of makes their life that much harder. So,
right. Because the idea isn't necessarily to stop them so much as to make it hard enough for them that they go somewhere else. Now, obviously, you'd prefer that they be completely stopped. But if it's just too much effort for them to get into your organization, then they may move on to another one because there are other there's a better return on the investment for them in those situations.
Yeah, to go somewhere else. Or provide lots of places for them to make mistakes so you can detect them. So threat intel, I don't think, is, you know, ATP, APT3s targeting our industry and using these 5 specific TTPs. This is for the top 1% of organizations that have done everything else. They already have all the basics covered. You know, they're red teaming. They've got all the script kiddie stuff done. And now they're looking at, how do we stop specific APTs? And maybe the government too, if they ever get to that point. They should be. I'd like to think they are.
Yeah, I won't comment on that. But another issue with this whole idea is that, you know, if you have a threat intel team, they're producing this threat intelligence, but what are they doing with it? I mean, is it in a form in that your monitoring team can consume that's going to be of use to them? Or is it sitting in a PowerPoint presentation or a multi-page Word document that the monitoring team doesn't have time to, you know, read, let alone take to heart what's in there or
implement.
I
mean, yeah. Right. How many APT reports have you read that you did nothing afterwards anyways? Because you read it and then you're like, oh, well, that's cool. And then you just moved on and, you know, kept doing your vulnerability management. I'd argue that's probably the right thing to do. I was actually that red report that we did a couple months ago. I need to go back, and there's so much content that can be built out of that. And I haven't built a single piece yet. I need to do that.
Well, get to work.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what should you do about it? Well, always keep a critical eye when looking at threat intels and don't go chasing APTs. Please stick to the alerts and the tools you're used to. I wrote that and I was like, don't go chasing APTs. Wait a second. That sounds familiar.
All right. Man, well, bonus content right there.
That looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.